Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Today in the studio for a second mentoring conversation, we have Tony Buettner. Tony, introduce yourself.
My name is Tony Buettner, and I feel great. Absolutely wonderful. Yeah, okay. Thank you for having me today. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, good.
So people are probably saying, well, what's this Blue Zones thing? Well,
We jumped around in our first conversation because we wanted to learn a lot about you.
Well, and we were having a lot of fun too, weren't we?
Yeah, and you've got a lot of history to share. With all your entrepreneurial background, don't you think that that contributed to your innovative Blue Zones company?
Oh, absolutely. I think as an entrepreneur, you learn how to take an idea, something that you're very passionate about, and figure out how can you share it with other people.
Yeah.
Be that what it is. And being an entrepreneur, you learn and you listen to the word no a lot, and no, that's not going to work, and why would you want to do that? And I think a lot of the skills that you learn along the way, all of us at Blue Zones are putting to work to really turn population health and healthcare upside down here in America with our Blue Zone projects.
Thank God.
Indeed.
All right. So we just want to clarify that your brother, Dan Buettner, did the research, and you came in after spending 20 years in the Virgin Islands and the Caribbean and running several different businesses. You ended up back at Minnesota. You had some unfinished business with finishing your degree, and so you finished summa cum laude or mega cum laude or
something like that.
Yeah.
Let's just put it this way. I went from a GPA of 1.71 up to a 3.83 30 years later. So, yeah, it was great. Going back to school.
Yeah, and then you got reacclimated to Minnesota for a few years and into a medical company because in 2008 there was some
economic downturn.
Yeah, and so you explored, well, what field industries are doing well and where can I plug in?
That's right, yeah.
And then Dan said, no, you cannot stay there. I want you in here
with
the Blue Zones. You know, you've got all the skills that you've learned. And
some days I'm so happy you did that, and other days it could be a challenge, that's for sure. But yes, I am a national speaker.
That's when you bring your younger brother into the peacemaker.
That's right, yeah. Nick, the peacemaker. Nick. So I do about 80 events a year now around the country.
Okay.
I probably speak to 30 or 40,000 people a year. What a gift to be able to do that and share that work. And I help lead our business development of Blue Zone projects. So communities around the country that have learned about our work and are interested in transforming and igniting economically and via health in their community, I'm the one that works with them to make that happen.
Cool. And tell us about the original Blue Zone communities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dan wrote about, and they're also featured in the National Geographic in 2016.
They are, yeah. Absolutely. And a lot of this information can be accessed on bluezone.com as well.
Mm-hmm.
Dan was asked by National Geographic to find the longest lived populations and report on why they live so long, as simple as that. He found, this is part of a 15-year ongoing worldwide longevity study. To date, he's located 5. And when I say he, Dan has worked with medical researchers, epidemiologists, anthropologists, demographers, nutritionists, and they actually embed themselves into these populations for months at a time to really measure, fact check, and figure out what's happening here. To date, 5. The first Blue Zone that was found is in the island of Sardinia in the Noro province. It's 6 villages, about 40,000 people up in the foothills. It's here that you find the longest lived men. They live 10 years longer than we do here in America. He then located Okinawa, Japan. It's here you find the longest lived women. They live 12 years longer than we do. 12 years.
Wow.
So you look at that and say, well, what can I learn from that to live a longer, healthier life? We looked for an American blue zone, and at first it looked like it could be southern Minnesota or northern Iowa. But when you deep dive into what's happening there, you see a population that's skewed because all the young people are graduating and leaving town. Hmm. So you have these skewed numbers. But we found America's Blue Zone in Loma Linda, California, amongst the Seventh-day Adventists there. And something called the Adventist Health Study has been tracking this population for about 35 years, and it's considered a gold standard epidemiology study. You find women living 9 years longer than everyone else, and men 11 years. And this is a community of 25,000 people in California that has the same challenges that every city in America does. So what can we learn from them? Since that time, we located the Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica. This is a population that has three times a better chance of living to a healthy age, 90. And lastly, Ikaria, Greece, an island of about 8,000 people right off the coast of Turkey. It's here that almost a perfect storm of longevity factors are coming together that is yielding a whole population that lives 8 years longer than we do, with just a fraction of the chronic diseases that we face and almost no dementia. So as we see dementia skyrocketing, what can we learn from that population?
Yeah. And what were the findings?
So Dan and the team discovered nine commonalities. And the first was, these populations aren't running marathons or going to the gym. They live in environments and have lifestyles that nudge them into physical movement on average every 20 minutes. Hmm. So they're not just jumping into a car and going. They're walking. They're biking. A lot of their activities are timed, honored to where they're moving, be it a garden or be it living in deconvenienced homes where they're not just pushing a button for everything they need. These populations have the right outlook. They have timed, honored strategies to reverse stress. Stress that causes inflammation, and inflammation that is associated with almost every preventable disease. So it could be yoga or praying. It could be having dinner with their family. It could be going to happy hour, but they have these timed, honored traditions. They have a profound sense of purpose. A purpose that gets them out of bed in the morning. And we know that people that have this sense of purpose live 7 years on average longer than those that don't. They eat wisely. We did see a small amount of alcohol consumption, typically wine, about a glass a day, almost always with friends, family, or a healthy meal. They ate mostly a plant-based whole grain diet. 95% of what they consume is plants. They do eat animal protein, but typically on average about five times a month, and the average portion size is about 3 ounces. So you don't see people eating the king cut 28-ounce prime rib. And they have strategies not to overeat. They will eat off of smaller plates. They'll pre-plate their food in the kitchen, put the leftovers away, and eat in another room. They'll eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper. Or the Okinawans, before they start to eat, they say this term called hare hachebu, and it simply means stop eating when you're 80% full. And lastly, these populations are connected. They put their families first. They keep their aging parents close. They nurture their children. They have faith. We talked to 263 centenarians in five places, and only three did not belong to a faith-based community. And now I understand that faith has many faces, and it didn't matter what the religion is, but research firmly shows that people that show up to a faith-based community and participate four times a month or more live 4 to 14 years longer than those that don't. We have no idea why. Is it the social connectedness? Is it the healthy behaviors? And lastly, they were born into or actively seeked out healthy friendships. And we now know that your three best friends, that these social connectors are contagious as a cold. And what I mean by that is if your three best friends smoke, you have 160% greater chance of smoking. It's the same with depression or loneliness. But imagine if your three best friends are supportive in your health behaviors, how contagious that could be through social networks.
Right.
So yeah, the power nine.
Yeah.
Lessons to live a longer, happier life.
That's awesome. And what I liked about the Blue Zone Solution, so there's two books. That, or is there a third one?
Well,
two?
There's four.
Four? So, okay.
Dan, with Blue Zones, it's original Blue Zones and Blue Zone Solution, but Dan has been hired by National Geographic to also study the happiest places in the world, and he's captured that in Thrive, and he has a second edition of that coming out this October.
Okay. All right. So I'll have to read that too. What I liked about the Blue Zone Solutions was the pilot program, and that's where they featured the Minnesota experiment, and also lots of recipes.
Yeah, I think when you look at health, I think the entryway or the runway to health is what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
When we look again at populations here in America, we see that 68% of people in America are obese or overweight, and that's unsustainable. And what does that cause? It causes us to lose and live an optimal, happy, healthy life. As I mentioned on your last podcast, the human body is programmed to live to a healthy age 90. And here in America, on average, we live to age 78. We're leaving 12 good years on the table. And what we do is look at the longest lived populations and look at how we can take the learnings from there and help change people's lives so they can get those last 12 years of happy, vibrant life.
Yeah. I went on the Blue Zones website and took the quiz.
Yeah, the True Vitality Test. It's wonderful.
Yes, yeah, it is wonderful. So there's like three different categories where they tell you, you know, a healthy life expectancy. So mine is 82.5.
That's great.
My life expectancy is 91.5.
Mm-hmm.
And then my potential life expectancy is 97.2. So there's ways that I could add 5.6 more years to my life if I, you know, if everything goes as...
Sure. Obviously, these are averages.
Right.
We use the CDC life tables. We use the learnings of Blue Zones and longest lived populations. That tool was developed by the University of Minnesota. And there's about 34 questions that look at what are your current behaviors? And helps you to understand how long you will live before you see a chronic disease, what's your potential longevity, and what are the simple evidence-based permanent and semi-permanent changes you can make in your life to get some of those good years back. So those are great numbers you had. You must be living a healthy, happy life.
Well, yoga has been helping and mindfulness meditation, that's for sure.
Indeed.
But yeah, I've really been changing my diet a lot. I think I had read about and learned about and watched a TED Talk of the Blue Zones and just seeing more, like, you know, more beans. I didn't realize that they're so rich in protein, and the dookie beans, you know, which I had for lunch today, and shiitake mushrooms and different grains.
We look at beans as the Blue Zone superfood. We see consumption in every Blue Zone. They are inexpensive.
Yeah.
They're good for you. And they're filling.
Right.
So the key is, how do we help people take the learnings of these longest lived populations and provide recipes so they actually taste good and sounds good?
Right. Mm-hmm. There's, yeah. And you get a lot of mileage from them.
That's
they
right.
They stay with you for
One of the things we learned in studying how we could work with restaurants in our communities was simply not to put the word healthy option on the menu.
Put zestful it goes, food
it goes
or something.
It goes to show that it's the one word that guarantees no one will order that item. People want food that tastes good. So why not, as you said, name it and present it as being fresh and zesty and tasteful.
Yeah.
We do know when people are offered a healthy choice, in a restaurant setting, 37% of people will order it if it's there in front of them. So our mission is to bring those healthy choices to light and allow people to know they're there, because we know people will order them and enjoy them.
So out of the original Blue Zones, you had a significant number of findings, which led you to a certain approach, which you call the life radius approach.
Yeah. So part of that research was figuring out what works in community health initiatives. And what we learned, and it took us 2 years to find this, that there's only been one in the history of men that's actually worked. And it was called the North Karelia Project. Back in the early 70s, Finland had the highest level of cardiovascular disease in the world, women and men in their 40s and 50s dropping over from heart attacks. And four medical students, launched an initiative that looked at environments and lifestyles to permanently and semi-permanently change that. And in just 4 short years, they were able to reduce cardiovascular disease in working aged men by 85%, and they have sustained that to date. With our research and our learnings, we developed what's called the life radius approach to population health, trying to affect people, places, and policies. So when I talk about people, we learned that you need a critical mass of engaged people. So how do you do that? How do you help them get involved to optimize their home? Because we spend so much time of our life at work, but we can have a healthy workplace. But if it's an unhealthy home, we're just going to dip right back into those poor behaviors. So we help people optimize their home. We learned so much about social networks and how important it is to have supportive people in your life that want to help you change your health behaviors. So we specifically looked at the Okinawans that have these things called moais. They're committed social networks that these people are put in at a very young age, and they're built-in support systems of friends that you travel through life together. We learned how important purpose was. So how could we help people identify those five things that they're so good at and their five passions they have, help them actually craft a mission statement, and then allow them to change or to share those passions with volunteer organizations in their community, because we know volunteers have lower rates of BMI and higher rates of well-being. And then we look at those places that we just mindlessly nudge ourselves through every day, our workplace, our restaurants, grocery stores, faith-based communities, employers, and schools. How can we change those environments? And then lastly, working with city leaders around the built environment to get people moving more, biking a little more, placemaking so people can congregate and create those friendships and have pride in their community. Tobacco policy, how can we help ongoing efforts to make it a little harder to smoke? Because let's be honest, it's not good for you.
Yeah, right.
And food. How can we make it cheaper and easier to get fruits and vegetables, right? And maybe make it a little harder to get junk food.
We mentor. A great place to bring Mike Kabea, our sound engineer and photographer, into our conversation. He's from the Republic of Congo. Tell us what's going on over in the Republic of Congo and how you grew up, that you're connecting with these principles and concepts.
Absolutely. As you can tell, I'm excited, you know, from behind the scene. I'm like, hey, Nessie.
I got a lot to say here.
I want to jump in a little bit and ask a few questions to this gentleman. Of course, I had a time to watch your presentation. I guess there's a super long movie where you just talk on and on about all these experiences you've been going through around the world while you're doing these studies. And, growing in Africa, I have recognized some of the things, some of the values. I think that's probably what is still to this day helping some of the Africans to live a little bit longer, despite, poverty and all the wars. And one of them was, you said, I guess it was in Okinawa, that elderly or seniors were respected and revered. And these are one of the things that struck me upon coming in America, where I felt like, well, people tend to respect youth. They think being young is the best thing. When you start aging, you almost become almost useless. You know, you're counting pretty much your days. You know, I'm almost 65. I'm going to retire. And then the next thing is what? You're going in a nursing home or something like that. I'm just wondering, with the research that you've been undertaking, how do you think that kind of mentality, the sense of respecting the seniors, can be incorporated in our environment in America?
Thank you for the question. Great observation, too. Here's one fact that I think we should start with. The two most dangerous years for Americans are the year first that you're born because of infant mortality, but the second most dangerous year is the year you retire. Now, why is that? Do you think that we just retire and then start partaking in risky behaviors? No. Researchers, well, at least not most of us, researchers have identified purpose as the reason for that, because you go through life getting up in the morning, going to work, taking care of your family and taking care of the needs of yourself and your loved ones. But when you retire, that all is askew. You have a 30% greater chance of having a heart attack in the year that you retire. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in every blue zone, we see elders revered. Have you ever noticed here in America, it seems like our social equity peaks in our mid-20s, and then from there it's all downhill. Well, that's the opposite in the blue zones. I look to Sardinia as a place where you find aging people absolutely revered. You go to restaurants there, and they have photographs of their centenarians on their wall. These people are revered. They are looked to as repositories of wisdom that people can go to and tap into those decades of wisdom. What's so important, though, is they don't just sit at home and waste away. They are expected to participate in the community and the family. They are tapped into by mayors and city government to help resolve disputes. But within the family circle, they are expected to get up and to cook and participate and take care of kids. And what's so amazing is what we found was these aging people taken care of by their families, they live an additional 4 to 6 years because of that engagement. And we saw this thing called the grandmother effect. Actually, the children of these extended families, the kids suffer lower rates of infant mortality. So taking care of your aging parents actually benefit everyone. And they are revered and they're respected. And I think that is just a time-honored tradition. And this is a personal thought that we've just started to forget a little bit in our busy lives, that there is a lot of wisdom. And what we do with Blue Zones is just bring back to the forefront the simple behaviors of the longest-lived populations and then look at how can we learn from that, remember those things, and put them into our lives.
Do you think about any particular methods or particular techniques, if you will, that you can use to actually make people start changing their thinking in terms of aging?
Yeah, I a couple things. I guess we see that longevity is increasing here in America. People are simply living longer, and I think you're seeing that those baby boomers that are reaching, they're not ready to sit on the couch. They want to live long, healthy lives. They want to take care of their kids and grandkids. And you see them being very much involved with their community, volunteering and sharing and mentoring. What we do within Blue Zones is help people that are like-minded, that want to change their health behavior, join these moais built upon the concept in Okinawa, where people can commit to walk or bike or to explore healthy eating or to explore their purpose. We put on purpose workshops where mm-hmm. we can help those people identify those passions and bring those volunteer organizations in the community together and provide them an outlet for that wisdom and those gifts. And in our schools, we have what's called a legacy project where we put together kids with folks in their 80s, 90s, and in some cases, centenarians, as a learning exercise of learning how these aging, wise people went through life and what can be shared from that, and then make those mm-hmm. connections there. There's a lot of benefit both ways to that. So just a couple ideas there.
Fantastic. While talking here about Life Radio's approach, you mentioned the policies, and that just carried me away. But I wonder if you think the politics have in some sense also an impact on the well-being. Because when I try to look at those people that you've been interviewing or whose life you've been examining, I tend to see a tendency to socialize. It's kind of a socialist mentality, if you will.
Yeah, I guess I differentiate the words socially interacting and socialism. These communities, they're well connected. And there's a lot of research that connectivity provides that sense of community, that purpose, that love of family, of faith, and helps drive extraordinary longevity. When we talk about policy here in America, what we simply do is work with nationally renowned experts that are either leading or have compiled some of the best activities that communities can implement, policies and programs around tobacco, food, and built environment. We don't tell anyone what to do, but what we do is help create a coalition of leadership and educate a community. We learn of what's working in a community, things that have been tried and failed or maybe are stumbling, learn about their culture, their priorities, their strategy, and educate them to what other communities are doing around these policies and help them decide what is the right path for them and then help them get those policies done. And I'll give you a simple example. In the beach cities, smoking there is below the national average, but they still wanted to drive tobacco usage down. And so when we brought our tobacco policy and learned about their priorities, they were very much ahead of the norm. And they had decided as leaders there, and this is the community and community leaders, to simply pass a policy that prohibits the smoking in the city. You simply cannot smoke in public or in public spaces except for your home. And now that's a decision they made. But the bottom line is they were able to reduce tobacco usage from what was 9%, which is way below the national average, down 17% more. So that's an extreme policy, but for every community, their leaders and their population, in my opinion, it's up to them to decide what they think is best for the health and well-being of their community around policies and programs. And what we do is help educate and create that ground cover with a grassroots initiative that helps those leaders make those hard decisions. Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed specific cases where people had like chronic diseases, seeing their situation being reversed as a result of trying to live by the blue zone code, if you will?
Yeah, so we measure rigorously everything we do three different ways. One is we have a third party measure our population health work, Gallup measures using the Gallup Healthways Wellbeing Index that measures about 40 indicators of well-being. So we baseline a community and then measure yearly, and it provides us this insight into truly what is the environment that's causing either good or poor health outcomes in a community, and helps enlighten our strategies. Every community that we work in, there's about 20 indicators that we look at, things like healthcare claims, tobacco usage, how many people are eating fruits and vegetables, five servings a day, tax rates, if we're working in the built environment, traffic issues. So we measure at a community level, and then every organization that partakes in a Blue Zone project measures something, grocery stores, restaurants, schools, employers. One of the, what I think is the best metric to date is in the Beach Cities, a community with about 130,000 people. We're now in our sixth year there. When we started, they had been measuring childhood obesity for 20 years, and the rate was right around 21%. A year after we started our work, we started to see that number come down, and 6 years later, they have dropped childhood obesity by 64%. So when you start to think about a generational impact, when you realize that these children are going to grow up healthy, they are going to start businesses, start families, share those same traits with their kids, you can literally see how this Blue Zone project and the efforts of those communities can literally change a whole generation of life.
Have you seen the documentary Babies?
I haven't.
It's worth checking out. It's the first year of life and they tracked children in different where they were where they grew up. So there was one family in California, there was one family in Japan, there's one family in Mongolia, and there's one family in Africa. They tracked the child's development and what the parents did and their influences in their life during a 1 year period. Anyways, I just thought it was wonderful and might spark some other ideas with projects that for research, they're, you know, tracking their early developmental.
Our first certified Blue Zone city was a community called Spencer, Iowa, a community of about 11,000 people. And when we started, the mayor there was on about 30 different pills. High blood pressure, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. When he learned that his community had been chosen to be one of the first four of 15 cities, during our first 6 months of planning and assessment and learning from the community, he committed himself to just simply start eating a plant-based diet, moving more, connecting more. And by the time that we did the kickoff event there, about a year later, he got up on stage, and I'll never forget it because it was one of the first cities that I actually, when I got employed, was in. And he stood up and said that he is no longer on any pills. So when you look at the power of following Blue Zone's principles, we let people in the community tell their stories, and that's one that certainly resonated with me. That's impactful.
Yeah, and that's the fact incredible. That you come back and check with these communities as well so that the research is carrying forward. So Matthew, Olivia, and I are part of a French African community, faith-based Catholic community, and what I love about the community is everybody hugs each other.
Oh, yeah.
And they look you in the eye and ask how you are. And we also have wonderful gatherings after church, which I think has been lost in a lot of faith-based communities. Like, we're not getting together as much. But part of that is, you know, issues going on in different faiths, you know, the Catholic faith and all the problematic hierarchy and so has caused communities and people to be disenfranchised with their faith. And so I hit through going through the process of, you know, how can I love my faith. How can I be connected with in an environment and with a community where I feel like I resonate with them? And, you know, long and behold.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very African. And I love to say that in Africa, it's not a problem to touch somebody that you don't know, that you've never met before. like we all ride buses. So you got on the bus and you're really tucked in and then you can't worry because somebody has touched you. No, it's almost abnormal to even look back to try to see who touched you. It's abnormal, you know. Yeah. Likewise, here's another thing that, you know, that struck me upon coming here is when you get in an elevator, you are two or three persons and you tend to see that people are just silent, like, you know, I don't know you. No, it's not. No. In Africa, when you find yourself in a small place like that, it's just automatic that you start talking. You start socializing immediately.
Right.
You don't need a clue.
There's a lot to be learned there. There's something called the Framingham study. It's a very famous epidemiology study.
Yeah.
That talks about the fact that 30 years ago, the average American had three best friends that they could count on a good day and bad day, and these friends would listen. Today, we're down to 1.5. We are becoming this isolated community. And I think any of your listeners, just look around. They see people just enthralled in their smartphones and kids on tablets. Yes. When I grew up, I mean, we're outside running around. Now look, today, you just don't see kids out playing around or social networks are and when I say friendships, we're just becoming isolated. I think there's a lot of wisdom to be to be learned by the power of community, the power of family, the power of friends, and how much influence they have in our life.
Yeah, and bringing different cultures into your life.
Of course.
Yeah.
We, in our early innovations, never had a specific product for faith-based communities, but we learned quickly, actually in Iowa, all the faith-based communities wanted to participate in how they could make that organization a place where healthier choices were easier. And so we've created a pledge and actually a sector now that we interface with in our community health initiatives because you can reach so many people. And Blue Zone Project is about choice, about 600 different evidence-based strategies people can incorporate into their lives. But what was really neat in our pilot is what we found was all these other faiths in a city, they weren't connected. So we were able to bring leaders together and create a committee.
And really have a talk to each other.
So they could understand common challenges, common opportunities. And part of that innovation was they decided the first weekend of every month to have a walk or bike to church day or weekend. So all of a sudden on the first weekend of the month, you literally see hundreds of people walking and biking to their faith. And I remember seeing it and going, I bet that's how it was 30, 40 years ago, but we just don't do it anymore. We think of how nice it feels to get that exercise and to interact with your neighbors or your family and show up and actually be ready to participate in whatever that gathering is. And we all know about potlucks at church. It's either really unhealthy food and donuts. Little tweaks like offering fruits and vegetables or healthy options, you could really affect a population by implementing the learnings of our longest lived population.
That's another thing at our community at St. Boniface is all the African women are making the food from home. And so, you know, the flavors of the food and making sure, you know, it's nutritious and there's plenty of it.
Yeah,
and lots of beans and rice and fruits and vegetables. Anyways, it's good to see that. And I just found that those are the things in a community that I felt were missing in my life.
Sure.
That were kind of built in with the group. Yeah. And I just so your research really resonates.
Yeah.
The other thing that we did when we were at Albert Lea that Ellen Kerr said really was great was the pledge, because you chose which category what you wanted to do. So it wasn't, you know, you being forced into a position that you have to do this.
That's right.
It's, you know, people have the choice and they own it. And so we have pictures of us signing the pledge. And
it was really
a fun experience. And to hear somebody, I don't think in a pilot program I've ever heard anyone like so excited. Like, she's the best spokesperson and historian for Albert Lee.
She is just absolutely incredible, and it just goes to show it's all about people in a community.
Yeah.
It's not about us coming in and doing something to a community. It's listening, it's finding the right partners in innovation and trying things.
I mean, obviously, in
Albert Lee, no one had ever done this before.
Right.
There were things that worked great, and there were things that were flopped, but we're innovators. So to have a partner into leadership there, Randy Kerr, who was a mayor, Ellen and Chad Adams, the city manager, and all the steering committee and the thousands of people there in Albert Lee that that were partners of innovation with us and tried this crazy project. My hats are off to those leaders, because it's that community that has done this. What's so nice to know is that when we started, Albert Lee was a 68th in their community health rankings out of 85 here in Minnesota, and they're now at 45. Mm-hmm. We see admissions in that county to emergency rooms down. We see tobacco usage down. We see chronic heart disease down. So it's just amazing the work they've done.
Yeah, excellent.
Oh, I had another idea that popped in my mind as I was watching the show and hearing you talking. I'm like, okay. First of all, my mind is kind of wondering. I'm like, okay. I mean, Albert Lee is doing so great, then in the long run, these techniques can be implemented almost all over the place in America. Why not? And kind of have the whole country as a blue zone. I mean, it's too idealistic, but I don't know if you dream in those terms. But
we do, just to be clear. Okay. We are in 9 states and 42 communities, so this innovation has grown. We would love to work with every community. I think what was really interesting is the work that we did with childhood obesity and the Beach Cities. It caught the eye of the Surgeon General about 3 months ago, and he actually took 3 days off to come and meet that community and to understand what strategies have been implemented. And we see a movement in the community, and you read about it and you hear about it a lot. How do we make our communities more walkable and bikeable? How can we look at best practice policies and create collective impact modeling to enable communities and empower them to change trajectory of health?
And how do you think you'll be able to actually help different or isolated communities to start integrating? My problem here is I tend to see that individual communities have things in common, culture and all of that, race as well. In such a diverse place, a cosmopolitan milieu like America, where race plays also a great role, do you think that would be a challenge?
Well, yeah, of course I do think it's a challenge, but it's not a challenge we can't overcome.
And how do you think you can overcome that, or at least
address it?
Well, I think if you look at our largest Blue Zone city, it's in the city of Fort Worth, Texas. There's over 800,000 people there. 53% of the population is either African-American or Hispanic. And we're having great success there in all of our communities. These aren't homogeneous populations. These are heterogeneous populations. They're cultural melting pots, as most communities are here in America now. And this is what we found in the Blue Zones. These were places where people came in, went out. The way that we approach that, and there's certainly populations that are harder to reach than others, but we spend the first 6 months of our projects doing outreach, planning, and assessing a community. And part of that is understanding that this can't be siloed. This has to be a project that's led by the community. So when we hire a staff, it mirrors the community. When we put together our leadership coalitions, which can range from 80 to several hundred leaders, we are looking at the challenges of the community within those hard-to-reach populations. We're looking at respected leaders in those communities or organizations that are already doing this work and making sure that they have a seat on the committees so that when we're educating and planning and equipping these leaders, their voice is heard so that each of these communities, when we deploy a Blue Zone project, is addressing that. And I'll just give you an example. I read in one of our reports last week. In one of the areas in Fort Worth, it was a food desert. And so people weren't able to get healthy options. And we were able to use a multiple-pronged approach of putting in several hundred community gardens and strategic areas in that neighborhood. We worked with one of the local grocery stores to put together a mobile market to serve at a certain time every day. And then lastly, we looked at the convenience stores, which we learned were places where people were getting their food and unfortunately no healthy options. We're able to, working with that mobile market, get fresh fruits and vegetables at a reasonable rate offered at the convenience stores. And then lastly, brought in a farmer's market where vouchers were created that if you bought a fruit or vegetable, you got an extra dollar for each of those spent. So there's strategies that are being deployed out there, but I think the important part is spending the time to understand where the challenges are in the subpopulations and to make sure that those populations have a voice at the table and that they're part of the solution.
From an entrepreneurial perspective, and you're growing the business, how do you preserve the essence of the work that you're doing when you have a great desire, great big vision, and keep the quality of work? And also, where does the funding come from with these cities?
Yeah, so I'll talk about funding first. We have seen five different avenues of sponsorship for Blue Zone Project, and it's typically those organizations where value flows or the alignment of our mission and our measurable impact align. So when you look at major insurers, their mission is to deliver on their mission of providing health.
Yeah.
And their bottom line is better served with a healthier population. So we've seen three of our statewide initiatives in Iowa, Oregon, and Hawaii, where the insurer has the majority of the market, and they want to deliver back value to their community, so they've sponsored these. With the Affordable Care Act, hospital systems are in complete disarray because they have been a fee-for-service organization up to now, and in the future, they'll be compensated for better outcomes. In other words, they need to start to become a partner in preventative health. And they're leveraging their relationships with large employers. They're understanding that typically their workforce is some of the most unhealthy in a city, usually one of the larger employers. And they're understanding that they can help differentiate and grow market share and deliver on their community health needs assessment by leading this. We see health foundations that have been set up to deliver on community health that have tried the siloed approach and aren't seeing the measurable impact that want to participate. And we're seeing major employers that want to differentiate themselves to compete in the market. For instance, in Fort Worth, Lockheed Martin, Dan and Yogurt, and Bell Helicopter are all Blue Zones work sites, but have contributed as a partner in that community. And then lastly, philanthropists that are looking for a true legacy project, one that is inclusive, one that is evidence-based, and one that's measurable. So that's where we're getting our funding.
Okay.
Yeah. The second question?
Is about how you're growing the business.
Yeah, so it's interesting how Dan Buettner, the CEO and founder of the community, has set this up. We're at multiple stages in each of these Blue Zone projects. They launch at different times. Our partners at Healthways that actually contract and deploy these Blue Zone projects in concert with us, they have a national team that sets these up and manages them. But what we do is hire all our staff and train them in the communities we work. We can't come in and tell the city what to do.
Right.
And a community health initiative needs to be led by the community, not only employees, but volunteers and leadership. So we've never brought an employee for a project, a local project, anyone in outside of being a mentor or consultant or helping to oversee. All our employees come from the cities we work. So as those projects roll off, these are 3 to 5 year projects, we're able to really identify the stars.
I see. And within the community.
Right. So when that project ends, those employees will be added to the national team. So as we scale, our national team is scaling, and the employees that we hire locally come from the community.
Oh, that's
so we're able to really strengthen a foundation of people that actually gone through a project from start to finish,
right?
So that they can be the
They understand the innovation and the different challenge. Phases and
what
the
works,
challenges,
what doesn't, yeah.
Right? And what you need to change going forward.
Yeah.
And to gather all the information and perspectives. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds fascinating. Do you have anything else you want to ask?
Oh, my God. It can go on and on. This is so interesting. And most importantly, results are there. It's palpable. So this is very exciting. Can't wait to live one day in a Blue Zone. That's all I can say.
Well, what I can say is 8 years after Albert Lee intervention, there are over 10 million Americans that are living in or around America's Blue Zone. So we're getting there.
Thank you for all the effort.
Well, and what's great about
the book is
you can start taking steps yourself. You've got the individual steps that you can do with your diet and walking and connecting in your communities. And you can start talking with your community leaders.
Absolutely. And remember, bluezone.com, there's a lot of information
there.
The true vitality test, there's a true happiness test, there's newsletters, recipes, tons of information on how you can optimize your tribe or family or friends, and optimize your home and take steps, small steps, evidence-based, all about choice to live a longer, happier life. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to add years to people's life and putting life into those years.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much. Great place to cap.
Well, it was an honor to be here, and thank you to your listeners, and thank you to both of you for having me today.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike, for joining in.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. Thank
you always
you for
add
the
so much.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see everybody next week, and we'll put some links on our mentoring conversation website. All right. See you next week. Bye.